Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Fred. I am responsible. I am accountable. I am capable of assisting people to find their true voice and then deliver it effectively into the world around us. With 40 years in mental health, 32 of them as a psychiatrist, and then a massive amount of conversations, including podcasting and expert speaking, keynote speaking, I have the opportunity to really see the magic that it takes to find one's authentic self and then deliver it effectively into the world. And if you're like me, you can see that now more than ever, that's what's called for. So today is that day. Now is that time. Come forth. Join me in the broadcast. You'll see on the other side of this, a true voice with Dr. Fred. Oh my God, the thing is just rocking now, dude.
Grooving, I could actually, music,
you know,
man.
What? Grooving, let's just cancel the podcast.
I'm, just, I'm like, still just it. Spinning. It's way more exciting than the old music.
It is. It's a really great job. So, tell your dad or your uncle, whoever it is, that he
good
did a great
stuff.
One on that.
Bring your uncle, your aunt, your uncle and your aunt. There's an aunt and aunt. Is there another term for uncle, like uncle and uncle?
No, that's a good question. Aunt and aunt.
Aunt and aunt, uncle... depending on like where you are, where you're from in the U.S.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything
know.
Other
That's
than
a
uncle,
really,
though.
Really good question. Now we got, look at that. We got the guy actually, like, he's not allowed to talk, but he's allowed to leave messages like that.
That's
you know,
great.
So he's like, he's way into us. He wishes we'd show up.
Thank you. Is it Thomas? I think it's Thomas chiming in. I love the messages. They're awesome. Uncle and uncle. Let's just go for it. Uncle and uncle.
Yeah,
TJ is his nickname. TJ. Awesome, TJ. Thank you,
Uncle,
TJ.
Uncle TJ.
Uncle TJ.
Uncle
Even
TJ.
Though I think he's 17. So if he's an
so
uncle,
so what, dude? You can be 17 and be an uncle. For
it
sure,
happens all the time down
south. You can
south
definitely be 17 and be a dad. You can be 17 and be a grandpa these days.
I know. I remember, when I turned around 40, and some guys from my high school had grandkids already, and I was like, wow, that's pretty wild. I still don't have kids.
Now,
I'm 47
with no kids. Did you grow up in
Kentucky?
Or where did you grow up? In Kentucky?
Where did I grow up?
Yeah, I kind of know. But...
Maine. Maine is North Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So what is the youngest grandparent on record? Has anyone
youngest
been,
grandparent on
has
record?
Has anyone ever been born? I guess you can't be born a grandparent.
That's a great question. Let's find out. Let's see if we can find out. Youngest.
I am looking at it right now.
Yeah? What are you finding?
Let's see. Youngest grandparents in the world. Okay. The modern society in the Western world, the average age is somewhere between 55 and 65.
That'd be like 24 or something like that?
17.
No. Oh, the youngest grandparent on record is 17.
Oh, you want to know the 15th youngest is...
Can you imagine?
Like Whoopi Goldberg was a grandma at 34.
I hope I'm not insulting any 17-year-old grandparents right now. But if you are a 17-year-old grandparent, I invite you to please call in because
we would love to hear from you on that one.
We should give the phone number out to any 17-year-old grandparents or anyone else for that matter. We will talk to anyone, whether you were a 17-year-old grandparent or a 18-year-old grandparent for that matter. 1-888-627-6008. You can call in if you're a 17-year-old grandparent, or you can call in if you're a 93-year-old grandparent. We don't care. We just like grandparents around here.
So here's the thing. The youngest one we have is a woman named Mumzai. And she's from Nigeria.
Okay.
And there was a city called Calabar, originally known as Akwa Akpa, where many ancient traditions were practiced, including childhood marriages. And back in the late 19th century, a girl named Mumzi was the member of this harem in Calabar in December of 1884. And she became a mother for the first time at a not so young age of 8 years old and 4 months, to be exact, giving birth to a baby girl. Given that it was a tradition to marry so young, it was no surprise that Mumzi's own daughter became a mother herself a little later than that, at the age of 9. 1 year older than Mumsy when she had her. That means that Mumsy became a grandmother at the ripe young age of 17. And that's Grandma the age Mumsy. When today's Grandma teenagers. Mumsy. What's that?
Grandma Mumsy.
Grandma Mumsy. And really, maybe Mumsy Grandma is just that might be another reason why we call some people probably call their grandmas Mumsy.
Grandmumsy.
Yeah, Grandmumsy. Whoa.
How far do you think you're off from grandparenthood, friend?
Within a year, but don't tell my daughter.
Within a year.
Yeah, I've heard.
Don't tell her, huh?
Don't tell my daughter. Yeah. She doesn't know that I know.
Are you sending someone to her house to impregnate her? Is that what you're referring to?
She's married, bro. And she's, I heard from the grapevine.
Wait, does her husband know this?
I'm thinking that she's after trying to have a child. That's what I've heard. I heard someone talking shit like that.
So you think that this is something that she actually already believes that she knows on some level, either conscious or unconscious.
She would be very happy with that outcome.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, right on. Well, congratulations in advance to your daughter. And congratulations in advance to you.
I know, right? Like,
does it feel good to be a grandfather in the future?
What's that?
Does it feel good to be a grandfather a year from now?
Yeah. It's the best thing since sliced bread, bro. I had no idea. You know, they say... And they say stuff like, you know, it's going to be great and stuff. But until it happens, you don't really know. And then it happened. Well, it will happen. And I'm just saying that once I'm in there, I'll be able to say shit like that. I'll be able to say stuff like, I had no idea how wonderful it was to be a grandpa. You know, the best thing is, at least I don't have to care. I don't have to care for him. You know, all that. All
you
got to
start rehearsing all those lines, all those standard lines.
Grandpa lines. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Popsy, mama just Popsy, Mumsy and Popsy.
Grandma.
So I
Mumsy.
Understand we're we might have a guest coming tonight, right?
No, he's apparently making a dinner for his cousin. He said he wants to join us next week. So I sorry for the premature excitement around that.
Okay, I was pretty excited about
that. It's the two of us today, Fred.
Well, we were just wasting time, and I was just kind of looking for Sean to come in and break the ice. So now we have to actually do something. I'm thinking, you know, maybe we don't go down these deep life rabbit holes and send my head twisting, you know.
Leave everyone in some kind of existential morass. Welcome to the True Voice podcast, where we will leave you in an existential morass.
Yeah, that's struggling to
get out of.
That's right. Actually, we do. Maybe that's why we don't have so many listeners. Let's try talking about the Giants.
Yeah. What are the Giants up to these days?
I don't know. I think the baseball season's over.
Aren't you?
But there is a New York
sports fan. What sport? Do you still watch sports?
No.
No.
No. I know enough.
Dead end street.
I know enough to have conversations with my son. But he already knows. I don't even have a TV, Sam. I don't watch.
But you used to be a huge sports fan. I think
way
this is something that the public doesn't really know about you.
I was way huge into sports. It's true. It was absolutely my number one obsession. When I grew up. So what I remember about this, especially during the time when I was like, you know, 5, 6, and 7, just learning how to read. My brothers, they were interested in sports, and my dad, like the newspaper would come in the morning, and I liked waking up with my dad before he went to work. So, it'd be like a puppy who hasn't got fed yet. I would wake up and sit right across from my dad and just wait for the sports page to come clear. And then I started studying that sports page like a journal. Like every day I would study the batting averages. I would study the box scores. I would study all the statistics of the football players. I knew every player on every team of football and baseball. And then I went to I went to somewhere between 300 and 500 Detroit Tiger games. I went there a lot. I went there at least 20 to 30 times a year. Yeah,
that's like going every day. This is over every day for a single year.
No, yeah, but no. I just went 20 to 30 times for a good 20 years. 20 to 30 times a year for 20 years.
Yeah, okay.
And you know, sometimes I would get off work. Like when I worked in the childcare job, they would let me off work at 9:30 or 10, And the stadium was only, so Sean's writing it back. He's saying he can't make it. You're right. Okay, good. Yeah, so as a childcare worker, I would flee down there and catch myself a couple beers and get, because you could get in for free after the seventh inning. And so I would get down there by the seventh inning and they would let me in the side door and I could just mosey my way up to like front row seats and have a couple beers and just watch the end of incredible baseball games. Really? I had so much fun doing that.
Last couple innings, huh? You get about, what, a half an hour, 40 minutes of sports?
Well, sometimes, like I remember one game when we were playing the Yankees. The Tigers were playing the Yankees. Both teams were very good. The Yankees were, you know, of course, a team filled with iconic players. Yeah. And there was a player named Dave Winfield. And
what
Dave
year
Winfield,
are we talking about, like 1952 here?
No, bro. This is we're talking about, let's see.
More like what, 78?
Maybe early 80s.
Okay.
And I watched some games that went into extra innings and they were the really fun ones because the place would be humming. It'd be 11 o'clock, 11:30, game still going on. And, you know, Tiger fans, Detroit is a pretty raucousy town. And so there'd be some raucous in the stands and we would be really, really rooting for our team and hating the Yankees. And, you know, I saw some really big home runs, some really big strikeouts. I remember one time sitting behind home plate and just watching Greg Maddux just mow down the Tigers. I, you know, just mow them down for free. It was really fun. I really had a great time at baseball. And then, you know, there was always college football. But when I moved to Chicago, that's when it got serious again. It got dead serious. Because in 1984, when I started med school, the Chicago Bulls sucked. They were the worst team in the NBA. So they got the first pick that year. And they picked a really important player that year. And he was the third pick that year. But he got to be pretty good. Michael Jordan became a Bull the same year that I came to Chicago. So I bought season tickets for the Bulls, not even thinking that I was buying for Jordan. I mean, Jordan was good, but he wasn't going to be. I didn't have it that he was all of it. And by 1984, I was going to 16 games a year right through medical school. And we went to probably 100 games during medical school as well. And we went to and then we had the Chicago Cubs. The Chicago Cubs were playing over there in Wrigley Field, no lights, you know, afternoon games only. So if you're going to skip class, no problem. If you're going to skip class, then the best way to do that is to go down to Wrigley Field. So I'd skip class every so often, and a lot of my friends would. And, you know, from Northwestern University, the Chicago campus all the way to Wrigley Field was a quick L ride. Maybe it was $1, $1.15 or something to get the L all the way down there. But you really could also just walk down there, about a 3-mile walk. And we would just spend the afternoon just basking in the sun, again, drinking beers or whatever, eating hot dogs. And it was a whole lot better life, actually, sitting in Wrigley Field watching the Cubs, you know, the pitiful Cubs, who up until that point hadn't won a World Series for like nearly a century. And just sitting out there in the bleachers, you could get tickets for a buck or two and just having the time of our lives, really, in the afternoon. And, you know, so between the NBA and Michael Jordan and the Bulls, and of course, Jordan got to be the best player of all time. And I watched him grow in it from the, you know, early years of his NBA career. And then the Wrigley Field scene where the lights got put in while we were there. You know, they put lights into Wrigley Field, I think, during my first year of residency. So maybe 1988 or 1989. They put lights in Wrigley Field, and that kind of changed things because we were really enjoying going to afternoon games primarily. And although I did go to the first night game at Wrigley Field, it kind of took away from the nostalgia because Wrigley Field had been the only stadium out there that still had no lights. And again, around that time, I was watching sports like a freak, man. I knew everything about baseball again. I knew everything about the NBA. I knew everything I needed to do about the NFL. Maybe not quite as much about hockey. I knew a lot about college football. And I knew, not only knew about this stuff, but I like cared about it way more than I cared about anything else. I cared about sports a ton, bro. I really did.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Fred Moss's monologue about the Detroit Tigers and post seventh inning. And it was riveting enough that I was actually able to go out to my driveway and intercept a pizza from the pizza guy and come back. And I probably almost didn't miss a thing.
Did you? Well, I was no longer talking about either the Tigers or the seventh.
Okay.
So you make it very clear that you
what's the new topic of conversation?
I was talking about, we went through just a tad. we did go a little deeper. We went back into Chicago and talked about the Bulls and the Cubs and the lights in Wrigley Field and me skipping medical school to go to baseball games and skipping medical school to go to NBA games too, and really watching the birth and genesis of Michael Jordan.
It just shows how exciting medical school is, huh?
Medical school just sucks. It just sucks. And it only got worse, really. I mean, medical school sucked, but the thing is that I've realized that way earlier than most people in my class did. So by second year, we had already planned our way to get through medical school, you know, because as they used to say, you know, P equals MD. And what that means is, you know, it was a pass fail system. So if you ended up in the top 97% in a test, then you pass the test. So there's 162 people in the class. If you end up in the top 97% of the test, you get a grade. It's called P, the path.
Okay.
And if you end up in the top 3% of the class in any particular test, then you get an H, honors.
Okay.
If you end up in the bottom 3% of any particular, and this is always true. It's always on a curve. So, if you end up in the bottom three, you get something called an F, which is, of course, failure.
Right. You know? Is there something beyond failure, though? Is there
No, that's it.
They don't give you extra credit for failing,
give each other
especially
shit.
Hard.
If you fail the test, you got some shit from your friends, for sure. Failing a test, you know, it was kind of a badge of honor. And Our friend is kicking in some good stuff here.
Yeah.
Expulsion is what we got.
That was close. I was close to that in my senior year in high school. You know, at least when it came to my trigonometry class, I think I went twice over the course of an entire semester. Mm. And I think on the third time I showed up, the teacher said, you know, Sam, you were failing this class. There's absolutely no reason for you to keep coming to this class. And I guess I shouldn't keep coming then, as long as I'm failing.
So you just got the F? You just took the F?
I think I just withdrew. I think I withdrew before the end of the semester, so I wouldn't actually get an F from it. But uh-huh. I was by that time, I was pretty fed up with the public school system.
Yeah, I hear you.
It was not treating me right. And you and I have talked about this in private before, but drugs were much more of a priority for me by that.
Yeah.
Time
drugs are really much more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Way more interesting. And you learn a lot more.
Way too. More interesting.
You know, you learn a whole lot more.
You learn way more. Start to see into these weird sort of unconscious intentions of the teachers that they don't even themselves realize. You know, that's very strange when you start to see into the transparent nature of the being who is supposed to be.
I'm flashing teacher. Back right now, dude. I am flashing.
Going, what unconscious drivers have you be at the front of this class thinking that you're teaching me something of substance right now and thinking that I should be listening to you?
That it is really fascinating. And you know, if I actually had the audacity, which I did, because I had to pass because I had to get to Ann Arbor because I was hoping that would be the panacea that I'd been looking for my whole life. And so I had to pass. I think I told you I made that deal with my English teacher.
Remind me.
Right. The deal goes like this. I was not going to pass the class. Right. And because I wasn't going to read a book, because I could not read a book. I wasn't into reading a book. I couldn't sit still long enough. I had way too many things to take care of to be reading some fictional American literature book. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't concentrate long enough to capture it. And I'm kind of a pain in the neck. So it was already like the seventh, you know, it's already like seventh hour. And when I would come in, I would usually be like already burned out from the day, you know, it'd be a long day already. You know, I had lunch and I never really ate my lunch, but you know, I had lunch. It was lunch hour and
smoked three joints by that time.
I'd be pretty toasted by the time seventh hour came.
Yeah.
So Mr. Constable and I, you know, after I think the first book we read was something called, I think it was Tessa the D'Urbervilles.
Oh, yeah.
And I read the book, I think, and I got a C or a D on the quiz. And then I decided, look, I can't justify reading any more books in this class at all. And
especially
so I went up
around about the time when you had Zeppelin and Springsteen and the Allman Brothers and all this great music hitting on the
exactly.
scene. Are you yeah. kidding me? Like,
I'm not going to be reading D'Urbervilles. Yeah, I'm not doing that. I think the second book was Henderson the Rain King. And I remember going up to him and saying something like, look, Mr. Constable, I really need to pass English, because if you fail English, then you have to do summer school or come back. I'm not going to come back. I'm a good enough student, but I'm not going to read any more books. So we need to make a deal. And here's the deal. I'm going to come in when I do, and I'm going to sit in the back corner, and I'm going to ask you not to call on me for any questions all day during the class. That's your deal to me. In return, I won't disrupt your class.
I love it. I love it. Oh, you leveraged. You leveraged your authority that you'd managed to put. There's got to be a term for that. I'm looking for some kind of a term for what you managed to pull off there. That is beautiful.
Yeah, it was important. It's called blackmail. I think that's the term they use.
I suppose that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what I would do, you know, and basically that's what I did. So I would actually get higher, but I would get higher right before class. So that I couldn't talk even if I wanted to.
Right. You wouldn't have made any sense.
Wouldn't have made any sense. And I would I would try to come in on time, because when I came in late, it'd be kind of a joke as I stumbled back to the back corner chairs. I didn't like being laughed at. So.
Yeah. You know, I had this English teacher who I got away with some shit with. He was the kind of guy who would go, and if he found you spacing out, he'd slap you with a ruler, he'd slap your wrist or your hand or whatever and wake you up. He was, you know, he's pretty strict. But he also happened to be directing the Macbeth play that was directly after class. And I happened to be playing Macbeth. And so everyone else would get the ruler slap, but I would get to take a nap during the class because he wanted me to be fresh for when I got on stage. So I got away with sleeping through his class where no one else could.
I see. That's a pretty good plan.
I got special privileges.
Yeah, no, that's a leverage. That's a leverage that's kind of inappropriate too.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I had a couple of
like
those
privilege,
inappropriate
privilege
leverage things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun when you're a kid and you can already see how to manipulate and leverage the system.
Right. Especially when a system that you don't really give a shit about at all. That's the other thing. Yeah. And some of these teachers know that.
That there are no shits to give.
Exactly. Some of these teachers actually know. They know that if you're giving them shit, it's because they deserve it. They understand. Yeah, exactly. They understand that this is just a masquerade.
They don't want to be there either.
They really don't. They really get that they're you know, they just assume be home and drinking there, we're doing whatever they're doing with their family.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, the public school teachers when I was growing up, I mean, they were making $24,000 a year, something like that, to put up with all this bullshit and teach us some nonsense that no one was going to retain. I mean, what a miserable job.
Terrible. Well, yeah. You know, for me, and I guess it's slightly different for you, but I guess, you know, given that you're a generation behind me, a full generation behind me, there was something about, you know, because marijuana was like still a secret drug for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah. you know, it was like opium is now or something, you know, it was like way out there, like, you know, and yet nearly all of the high school students of any stature whatsoever were smoking a little bit or a lot of it. And we had a field. It was called The Field. It was that capital T, capital F for sure. It was called The Field. And The Field was an unmowed plot of land right in front of the high school. And it went for a while. So you could walk into this rose bushes without getting to, you know, they were planted nicely enough so that you could walk in and then not be seen from school. Like you walk into the field and it was tall enough so that the teachers and the principals could not see. They could see you going in, but if you already got in, they couldn't see you. And then there were certain areas they had, you know what they had? They had those rose bushes had little prickers, right? Little pricker, like pricker branches. And they served like excellent roach clips. Mm. So you could poke the bottom of the joint with it without having to bring those alligator clips into the field. So it was like just a sea of roach clips and roses. Roach clips and roses, basically.
That's hilarious.
And if you wanted to know where the party was, you already knew. The party was always in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And if the field, unfortunately for the principals, especially the vice principal, his name was Mr. Leland. And he was out to get us whenever he could. He would find us and get us. Unfortunately, Mr. Leland walked kind of slow and kind of clumsy. And for like he would have to walk across the street to the field to get into the field if he had heard something was going on in the field. Right? He would have to walk from the school to walk across the street to the field.
Okay.
That couldn't work because as soon as he got to the street, the whole field, Leland, like that. He'd just be busted. We'd put out our joints and it'd be like, yo, Mr. Leland, what's happening? And it was like he never could catch us. He was like a cat. And it became a real game of cat and mouse because.
Oh, that's brilliant.
There was no way of us getting caught. They weren't going to be able to come in through the back. That's where the main road was. Mm-hmm. And so the only way they would come in was through the front. And everybody knew we were out there. And literally, Sam, there was at lunchtime on a nice summer day, I'm estimating there'd be 100 kids out there. Like 100 kids in different pockets.
Holy shit.
And you know what you could see that was really fun? You could see smokestacks coming out of the field. Like you could see where the party was by like, you know, just the smokestacks over the fire. And
amazing.
It was cool, dude. It was cool. And then in the winter.
Amazing.
In the winter, there was they had just built an indoor swimming pool. And they would, you could get into the back door of the indoor swimming pool. And there was a hallway that was called the hallway. That was called the hallway. And the hallway circled around the swimming pool. So if it was raining or if it was cold, we didn't go out in the field during those days. We would just go into the hallway.
Okay.
And in the hallway, there'd be a lot of Marlboros being smoked and Cools and Newports and all that.
Yeah.
But they were only being smoked to mask,
of course,
what was really intending to be smoked.
Sure. Yeah.
That was high school.
You're in less trouble if you get caught smelling like a Marlboro than if you get smelling like a joint, basically.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know what's funny, though?
That was high school. That was high
70s.
School.
that weed was like opium in terms of the judgment that people had about it. But I wonder if maybe by the time I was in high school, it was actually even more kind of like, you know, we were going through a very conservative time. Yeah. And back in the 70s, at least there was sort of this widespread kind of counterculture thing happening. And then the 80s, kind of, you know, the whole war on drugs, the whole DARE, yeah. Ronald and Nancy Reagan and their DARE campaign, yeah. and all of that. It really kind of squelched the whole drug thing, at least for the youth. And by the time we were smoking weed in the early 90s in high school, it was, there's a small percentage of us compared to the entire class, but we definitely had our stoner club for sure, and it was one of those things that just brought us that much closer together because of the fact that we were the real stoners in high school.
Yeah,
we're getting some good commentary here in the chat from TJ here.
Yeah,
homeschooled for most of high school and a bit of a goody two shoes. He's never done anything like that. That's insane.
I know. It was kind of insane. It was kind of.
Oh boy. We have some stories. We have some stories to tell you, TJ. Holy smokes. High school. That was the craziest time of my life.
Yeah. I think mine too.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe this is the high school episode. Let's go to your ads. We'll come back on the other side of this.
All right, let's do that. Let's rock
the high school episode with Fred and Sam.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Fred again. I wanted to explain to you a little bit about one of the names I have called the Undoctor. What is the Undoctor? Well, after about 15 years in the field of me being misaligned with what I was doing, because I was medicating people even knowing that medications were not the right answer, and I was diagnosing people even though I didn't always believe that they had the diagnosis that I said that they had, even though they did meet the criteria, etc., I like seeing humans for exactly who they are and who they're not, and not as a diagnosis. So in 2006, I began the process of becoming the Undoctor. I unmedicated, undiagnosed, and then undoctrinated a bunch of people. Like, people no longer had to come to a psychiatrist because their condition's cleared. This isn't true for everyone. It may not be true for you. But for some folks who know that their diagnosis doesn't fit and who know that they don't want to keep going through with medications and don't want to be seen as someone who's defective or afflicted, this turned out to be a great intervention. Over time, I stopped doing that, and I no longer do a whole lot of conventional psychiatry. Now I just help people walk through their life and find their true voice. I connect with people straight up, not as if there's a power gradient between a doctor and a patient, but as two humans connecting and resonating with each other. As it turns out, that's where all healing emanates from. So today, I've developed the Welcome to Humanity brand over the last 6 or 7 years, and that really takes into consideration all of this. It is self-explanatory. Basically, each and every experience that we have with humanity is just as exquisite as another, even if it's deeply uncomfortable. From there, we get to actually share these human experiences. From there, we get to resonate and connect, and from there, healing takes place. I also have been helping people with their true voice, and that's why you're here today at True Voice with Dr. Fred. I help people find that true voice, really their authentic self, their core value system, and then deliver it effectively into a world that is eagerly awaiting to hear you. Without your voice, no one will ever hear you. And without your true voice, no one will ever know you. But with your true voice, you can find healing, peace, and love. True voice is what it takes to end all wars. So, welcome to True Voice with Dr. Fred.
All right, rock and roll, man. let's get into it.
Yeah. So you mentioned there was some great stuff going on in the rock and roll world while I was in high school. And I think that was actually true for you too. You know, there in the 70s, you know, everything from, that's what really drove the whole machine forward, was how much the music, how amazing the music was. That was all mm-hmm. that we really needed every day. That's all that we really needed.
I am so envious of that time. It was so much of one's incredible. High school experience is defined by the music that's alive at that time. So tell us about some of the music that was alive.
I can't even start to tell you, you know, not only, you know, the Beatles had just sort of come to the end. I guess that was in 71. But as soon as we entered high school, which was 1972, the amount of great rock and roll that we were experiencing we didn't even know how great it was until the bullcrap that has come afterwards. We knew it was really, really good. We were really enjoying it. But the fact that this stuff has lasted 50 years, and it's lasted because it's freaking phenomenal. Like, you know, I told you I had gone to a bunch of Tiger games. I went to more concerts than I did Tiger games. We went to concerts 3 or 4 times a week. And the concerts would be at the smaller venues, Michigan Palace, and there was another one called the Masonic Temple, and then there was Cobo Arena, and then later Joe Louis Arena, Cobo Arena, and then there was, you know, we went to these, just anyone. I remember Jay Giles was super huge, Jethro Tull was super huge, Yes was super huge, and then, you know, the big shots like Zeppelin and the Stones and you know, Pink Floyd and all the ones that have lasted over time were all super huge. But, you know, even all the bands that came out of Woodstock were still playing. So they all showed up, you know, and they just would show up and we would just go there and watch 2 or 3 bands. And, you know, we'd watch the bands and then we'd watch their cover bands, or not their cover bands, their lead bands, you know, their, what are they called? Like, what's it called when someone shows up before the main act?
Opening act.
Opening act. So we would sometimes see 2 opening acts of bands that were about to be amazing, right? Yeah. Like we would be able to assess them and go, whoa, that's cool. You know, like I remember Ziggy Marley, we saw him once, and we saw, you know, even Elvis Presley.
Did you see Bob Marley while he was doing
it? I never saw Bob, but Barb was around. I never saw him. No.
Okay.
No. Yeah. But I kind of saw pretty much everyone else. You know, Clapton, he would come around, and, you know, Jeff Beck would come around. We saw him, and you name it, man. We saw a lot of series. Emerson, Lake and Palmer, that was an amazing band. And and then Bruce Springsteen, you had mentioned him, you know. Things were getting a little rougher in your hero's world when Bruce Springsteen was coming around. So that was like, you know, early 1975. And my disillusionment with education and with the world at large was growing very quickly. I was like, man, this place sucks. It was rough times. And I just felt that people were just selling out all over the place. And then, you know, one night I got this opportunity to take this long drive to Ann Arbor with my friend Mark and, in a Mercury Capri. He had his driver's license. And so we were, you know, we were given an opportunity to see this guy. His mom was a music critic. And she told us that there was this guy, he was going to be the next Bob Dylan. He was playing over there in Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor. And so she couldn't go. She was going to wanted to do a review or something. So she told us we should go. So we spent $9 a piece. We got in this Mercury Capri. It was a snowy day. I later learned it was September 23rd I guess that's my senior year. And it's September 23rd because I found some of the tapes of it. I recently, my sister and I got some tapes of it because we went over to Ann Arbor and the place wasn't even full. Nobody had ever heard of it. 75.
Okay. So this is a month and a half after I was born.
Yeah, a month and a half after you were born. And so, yeah, we went there and it was open, you know, it was open seating, general admission, place was only half full, best acoustics in Michigan. And we just sat down. We had no idea who we were about to see. And then 4 hours later, we knew we had seen somebody because he had two intermissions and he played his freaking ass off.
Springsteen in 75.
Springsteen, the first show, the first Born to Run show. Yep, first Born to Run.
My God.
And the Detroit Medley, you know, Detroit Medley, he does that. He did that at every concert since then. He opened it. I later learned that this was the first show that he had ever done that. And so he did that every show afterwards. With Good Golly, Miss Molly, and A Twist and Shout. It was a man, it was just awesome shit. It was like we were just dancing and screaming and sweating, and it was the most amazing musical experience to date, even as of right now. And we lost our voice. We couldn't even speak on the way home. So we didn't say anything to each other on the way home because we had been dancing and screaming and singing the whole time. But when we got to school the next day, because we were out late, you know, we told all our friends that we had seen the best concert in the history of the world. And then we heard a couple of days later that he was actually coming to Detroit a few weeks later. So we bought all the tickets in the second row, all the tickets that were there, 12 tickets in the second row. And then we distributed them to our friends and our family. So my sister went with me, and Mark's brother went with him. And then we took 10 of our best friends, or I guess 8 of our best friends. And we promised them that it would be the best show they ever saw, or else they could get their $9 back. And we all went there, and you know, nobody needed their $9 back. That's for sure. This was like the best fucking show in the history of time, man. This is before Bruce knew that he was a big shot. He had never been to Europe. He had never even traveled to Europe then. Like he had no idea that he was on his way to stardom. He's just a dude coming out of Asbury Park, man. And he had no idea. And Clemens had no idea. And, you know, Stevie had no idea. None of them had any idea, man. Max had no idea, but that was the band, the E Street Band. And good shit.
Amazing.
Super shit. Super awesome.
Amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah, my sister and I were remembering that just this week. I saw a show where I guess you probably know a band called The Killers. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. That guy's good. That guy's good, man. I never really heard of him. That guy is good, man.
Yeah, the talented. One of the few great bands of the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah, really great. Really great. Mm-hmm. And so there's a show where The Killers, what's that guy? I don't even know who the main dude is. I guess he is highly influenced by Springsteen. And so he was doing a show at Madison Square Gardens a couple weeks ago and Bruce showed up. They did three songs together. And this was this guy's dream. Like Bruce showed up and just kicked ass at 73 years old. I'll send you that video. You all should look it up, man.
Ah, fantastic. I love that. I love that. Yeah, my generation, early 90s, we had it was Guns N' Roses, and it was Nirvana, and it was Pearl Jam, and Primus, and Ministry. It was this sort of combination of super hardcore and the alternative music. I had a band in high school called Seizure Salad, Seizure, Seizure Salad. And it was fun. We had some original sort of grunge metal songs that we did together, and it was a good time. It was really good times, and it was definitely the music defines the high school experience. And yeah, I'm lucky I'm alive from my adventures in high school. That's for sure.
Yeah, LimeWire.
I haven't told your audience about the Marlboro.
Yeah, I know you're ready to do that. Let's see. We got time for that. You should.
Yeah, we got a few minutes for tomorrow.
I'm going to step aside for a minute and you go ahead and begin that.
All right. Sounds good. All right. So the Marlboro started out as a 1980 Volvo station wagon, brown Volvo station wagon. And bought it up in Bangor, Maine, grew up in Maine. And shortly after buying it, I would drive around and we would go and park myself and my friends, we would go and park in these little areas called roundabouts. Now, in Maine, you've got a lot of area that's just forest. And occasionally you have these little spots where there's going to be a future development. And so there is a pull-off off of the main road, and that pull-off would go down and around a sort of key-shaped circle and back out that driveway. It was the perfect place for little 16-year-old stoners to go and drive their first car and go pull off and smoke weed with the windows up and hotbox the car without anyone being able to tell you were there. There was no way that the police would know that you were there because they just didn't know to monitor the roundabouts. So one day we drive down into a roundabout. We park down at the end of the roundabout. We pull up the windows, roll up the windows, and we start hotboxing this car. And the car is just full of smoke. And I turn around, I look over my shoulder at one point, and I see that my buddy Nate is writing with a Sharpie, a black Sharpie, on the door of the car, the inside of the door of the car. And I see him writing, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? I just bought this car, and now you're writing with a Sharpie on the inside of my car? And he goes, dude, don't worry about it. So he finishes, and then he says to me, he goes, check it out, man, check it out. So I turn around and I look behind me, and it says Marlboro Racing Team, Marlobodo Racing Team. And I said, Marlboro Racing Team? And he goes, oh, shit, man, I meant to put an R. So from that point on, my car became known as the Marlboro. And the guys who rode around in this car regularly became the Marlboro Racing Team. And that was just the de-virginization of this car. From there, it went crazy. The next thing that happened was a friend took a razor blade and cut my glove box into multiple pieces. So my glove box became a jigsaw puzzle. You could take the pieces of the glove box and you could arrange the pieces back in the shape of the glove box. And then we took about maybe a dozen Day-Glow paint markers. And anytime anyone would get in the car, they were invited to draw whatever they were inspired to draw. And most of the time when people were in that car, they were incredibly high. So there are all these psychedelic drawings. There's psychedelic art all over the place, on the stick shift, on the speedometer, on the odometer, on the gas pedal, everywhere. The car was covered in psychedelic artwork. Then then people would take things like gummy bears and they would light them on fire and stick them onto the dashboard. Or light up, like there was candles dripping down the dashboard. There was incense. Your producer's asking about being on the car in that car on LSD. Yes, we were in that car on LSD on many, many, many occasions. Sometimes creating the art while on LSD inside of the car. So yes, that was definitely experienced many, many times. We had a little statuette on the dashboard that was part fairy and part goblin. The bottom part was a fairy dress, the top part was a goblin body. And we've called that little fairy goblin thing Russell Ross because of some interaction we had with a drunk woman in Portland about some guy named Russell Ross who she was trying to find. The whole car became like this mythic experience. And then when we ran out of space on the inside, people started drawing on the outside. So I came out of a rave one night in Rhode Island, high on acid, and I walk out into the parking lot and I see my friends on the roof of the car, and they've moved on because there's no longer any surface area on the interior. So they started drawing on the exterior. Next thing we know, the tires and the wheel wells were all different colors. It said Groove in graffiti across the back. The rubber bumper was painted chrome with purple stripes across it. I once got followed with a cop about 50 feet behind me with his brights on for about 3 miles while tripping on acid, driving that car with Groove spray painted against the back of it. And I thought, okay, if I get pulled over, I'm done. it's just, I'm done. Because there's no way I would have been able to form a sentence. I was 18 years old, high on acid, being followed by this cop. Boy, holy shit. I was white knuckling it to keep between the lanes. So anyway, all you kids out there, don't drive on acid. I don't think I need to tell you that. That's my disclaimer. Sam did not tell you to drive on acid.
Do you have any pictures of that thing?
I do. I think there's only one picture. The moral to all of that is don't drive on acid, even though I managed to avoid arrest.
The other moral is stay on the road, somewhere. Dude.
Stay on the road, dude. Stay on the road, dude. Exactly. So yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I could go on and on and on for hours on that topic.
What happened to your car?
Oh God. You know, I sold it to a buddy for $100 because then he said that he didn't want it. It was going to take too much it smelled horrible. I had a maggot infestation in the wheel well of the car because of a guy who stored Little Debbie's in the wheel wells, and he thought he had a hiding place in the wheel well of the trunk of the car for his munchies, but he forgot that he put his munchies in the wheel well of the car. And meanwhile, some maggots got in and started eating the Little Debbie's. And so I had a maggot farm that literally smelled like someone had taken a shit in the car. And we couldn't figure out why it smelled like someone had shat in the car. We know no one knew no one had, but it smelled like that. And so eventually I finally peel up the floor panels and I see that there's a whole maggot infestation in my car. So I clean the thing. It just got worse and worse and worse. Someone vomited in it at one point. And it just got so bad. I sold it to him. I sold it to a buddy for $100. He went and checked it out. He said, "You know what, Ben? I can't take this. It's so beyond the beyond now. So right now, it's a piece of psychedelic scrap art." Yeah, it was amazing.
What was it? A Volvo?
1980 Volvo wagon, brown Volvo wagon. I once jumped a swamp with it and actually tried to jump a swamp and landed in the swamp and steam came up out of the stick shift where the steam was pouring through the stick shift and into the car. I went to open the door and the door was submerged in the swamp. So I had to climb out the window onto the hood of the car and walk to the party that I was going to. And people used my car as a bridge all night long. They're like, "Sam, thanks for parking the Marlboro in the swamp, man. Appreciate it. Now I don't have to get my feet wet." We had to take a farm tractor and pull the Marlboro out of the swamp the next day.
All right, so here's the story, man. If you all thought that the reason that we didn't know how
to... thought these old men didn't know how to have a good time.
If you ever thought that we didn't know how to have a good time, this is showing that we do. Yeah, I know. Your life is boring, TJ. It's true, man. What are you doing with it? You're covering me and Sam while we podcast. You can't even come on the camera or speak, man. Yeah, it's time to turn around your life. It's time to find your true voice. It's time to actually get in line with who you really are, TJ, and actually start making some moves to get a life to work. Shit, man.
That's one way to do it. Well, my God, we could go on for hours.
And we have gone on for hours. And it's important to see that if you get a life like Sam and I have had in our own respective ways, then you get to go down these deep rabbit holes because somewhere along the line you were, you know, like in a gutter somewhere or, you know, didn't have anything else to do is start thinking about what the hell is this life about anyways. And then we got to search hard into this stuff. And then sometimes with the help of drugs or crazy people or crazy experiences, We can't, we collectively, you know, separately and collectively came up with the idea that there's actually nothing to look for. So,
yeah. You know. And there's no linear way to do it right. You know,
no.
It's life should be your palette and your canvas.
Yeah.
Paint your picture however you want, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the thing that I've taken away from all of this more than anything, is that there is no linear trajectory to a good life. It is a good life is an exploration, an ongoing exploration.
Well, I think, you know, Sam, so we should tell the public, or at least the one or two folks who are still left listening to us here, that that you did the Gene Keys thing today. They joined me in the Gene Keys Delta today, and we're really going to start looking at life in a different way. I'm really excited for you to be in our little group. And so the Gene Keys Delta is something, and that, you know, TJ, you should really look into that. GeneKeys.com. G-E-N, like Gene Keys, genetic keys, Gene Keys. And it's an opportunity to look at different ways of managing life. And there's some really beautiful courses in there, a beautiful book and a beautiful reconstruction, reconfiguration about how life really moves. And this nonlinearity is just a simple subset of the whole thing. You know, Richard Rudd, the writer of this, is very aware that there's nothing linear at all. And in fact, it's not even him that's aware of it. He got it kind of mythically and mystically run through him, and then transcribed it from a download that was, you know, just given to him over some period of time. And it's an amazing way to get access to a new way of looking at life. So I do suggest it for anyone who's curious about that kind of thing. And if you're on this call still, and you've enjoyed this little ride today, and you've been on any other calls from us, my guess is you really would appreciate the Gene Keys. With all that said, Sam, that's the end of True Voice with Dr. Fred this afternoon. How can people get a hold of you, Sam?
ZenWarriorTraining.com.
Zen,
or email me at Sam@ZenWarriorTraining.com.
Sam@ZenWarriorTraining.com is a great place to get a hold of Sam. He's totally hilarious. And, you know, you could actually call him if you just want to get the next chapter of the Marlboro. You could do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We can just chat for a while. I'll tell you about the next chapter of Marlboro. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I don't need your business. We'll just tell stories.
Yeah. And I actually, you know, I got only a bit to offer. I can help you find your, you know, life. If you're living a loser life, it's time to actually turn that thing around. And a way to do that is actually get in touch with your true voice. And a way to do that is to, at least one way to do that is to join this like-minded individuals who are, you know, signing up and being with True Voice and really finding what really matters to you. And then taking those steps to really walk the walk that is consistent with who you know you really are that you have not been. And that's what True Voice is about. You can find me at truevoicecourse.com is one space. That's where the course is. Or direct to me at drfred@welcometohumanity.net. That's drfred@welcometohumanity.net. I also got stories that I'd be glad to share with you. And I'd love to hear what you're thinking about life and how you're thinking that, you know, things need to go from now until they throw dirt on your face. And at that point, what are you going to do with yourself between now and then? That's the kind of question that both me and Sam really help you figure out. And it isn't a matter of, you know, it's not a linear task. It's not a linear journey, but there is something here about finding really what matters to you and then stepping into it. Anyhow, Sam, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making it light and easy today. Be well. TJ,
as always, brother, thanks for inviting me.
You bet. And next week we got a guest. Next week, y'all got to tune in for our good friend, Sean Anton, who's going to join us. And that should be a raucousy party as well. So we'll catch you next week. And peace. Love you all. Bye for now. Love you, Sam.
Love you too, Fred. Cheers.
Hello, everybody, and I just wanted to thank you for getting through another episode of True Voice with Dr. Fred. Wasn't that great? It is so much fun to interact with people and then interact with my listenership about really finding True Voice and then bringing it forward. I really have never done anything more important than this, and I'm finally aligned with myself by helping others find their True Voice. Let's find your alignment. What do you really want in your life?